Hi, this is Nick Dow, and together with my wife Mally and her friend Jim Smith, we've got a story to tell you. In actual fact, it's a musical story, and we want you to accept our invitation to take a melodic stroll by the canal. Just us and the ghosts of times past. Does that sound idyllic? Well, that's really where our story begins as we consider the reflections on the canal. The construction of our waterways, whilst not unique, must stand proud in the chronicles of human endeavour. Hand-hewn from earth, rock and mud, they lie peacefully as a tribute to the men who broke their backs working in the cut.
The waterways, in their peaceful settings, are not such a far cry from the armies of banditti, bankers or navvies, as they were more commonly known. Unbeknown to us, we may pass the bones of those workers who died in a rockfall or choked out his life beneath a slide of muck, buried, more often than not, in an unmarked grave beside the canal he helped to build. Shovelling muck was the navvy's fate. Muck would refer to any material to be found on the end of a navvy's shovel, and a close-knit community built up around the job in hand. A community with its own language, morality, lifestyle, and of course, its own songs. Nobody really knows from where the navvies originated. The late 18th and early 19th centuries saw a vast army of itinerant workers tramping the roads looking for work. Agricultural labourers, dispossessed by the enclosures, looking skyward at a blazing sun or threatening winter, and over their shoulders at the parish relief supplied by the austere workhouse. The wild geese of Ireland, escaping starvation and heading for the new world, were equalled maybe not in numbers, but in hope by those who set their sights on England and the canals as a way to fill their bellies.
We've scant memories of our hard-working forebears. A few graves stand in paltry tributes with their community names etched as a memorial. Dandy Jack and Alice Free lie next to each other, possibly man and wife, more probably living tally or having jumped the brush as a means of common law wedding.
As the navvies followed the work, so the women followed the men and lived their lives on the lines, surviving day to day, living in a shanty, probably built by herself from scraps of canvas, bits of wood and tin, in fact anything to keep the weather out and so protect her children from the elements. She was the one who kept everyone's body and soul together with the inferior food bought from the tommy shop. She was the one who waged war on the muck that encroached on their shanty, and she was the one who was left to cope if her man was killed in a fall of earth. Compare our lives with our constant hot water, microwave ovens and vacuum cleaners to her life, and we really should not complain. Deep respect is owed to these women, who were known then as tent girls. Oh, my name is Alice White, I'll have you all to know. And I left my father's farm a long time ago. My mother called me a silly lass, she said I'd rue the day that I followed on the heels of the navvies. Now my first man, Dandy Jack, he was so handsome, young and fine, and I loved him right through England as we tramped from line to line. We lived in shanty houses with lodgers and children three, and I worked to fill the needs of the navvies. Now when Dandy Jack were killed beneath a fall of stone, Oh, I wept and I cursed the day that ever I was born. Still my children needed feeding. I and many men looked at me. So I jumped the brush to stay with the navvies. Time came I was deserted when me children numbered five. So I got me yet another man for to keep us all alive. And as I've known so many men, they called me Alice Free. As I lived me life away with the navvies. Ah, but now I'm getting old and I'm grey before me time. With the work and the childbearing, as I've tramped from line to line. Still I'll never forget my sweet dandy Jack, lying so cold in his grave. He was the only one I loved of the navvies. Yes, the only one I loved of the navvies.
The community, for the most part, was illiterate, and none of the songs that abounded were ever fixed in writing until the first folk song revival at the turn of the century. Even then, the Victorian and Edwardian song collectors turned their attention to rural song, hoping to glean a song utterance from paradise, as opposed to a cry from the smoke and turbulence of the Industrial Revolution. Navvying songs may be few in number, but they give an insight into a world that was as insular and independent as any we have seen since. Those songs that have survived tell of the navvy's system of contracting out, whereby one navvy, who was able to read and write, would set himself up as a ganger and assemble a navvying crew and tender for one part at least of a job on offer. Money was available for the making, and numerous gangers made their fortune, maybe founding an alehouse with the indecorous name of the Grinning Rat, now a derelict shell on the Leeds to Liverpool Canal, or the more popular Navvy's Rest. Others drank themselves to death or lost their fortunes as quickly as they made them.
When I was young and tender, I left my native home, and often through old England's lanes I was inclined to roam. Oh, I was inclined to roam. As I walked down through Bishopstown, searching for employ, the ganger there he knew by me, I was a navvy boy. That I was a navvy boy. And as soon as I did get employ, for lodgings I did seek, and it happened to be that very night at the ganger's I did sleep, at the ganger's I did sleep. And he had one only daughter, and I became her joy. She longed to go and tramp it with her own dear navvy boy, with her own dear navvy boy. Said the mother to the daughter, I think it very strange that you should wed with a Nabean boy, the whole wide world to range. Oh, the whole wide world to range. The Navvies, they are roving lands, they earn but little pay. How can they maintain a wife and child on 14 pence a day? On 14 pence a day. Said a daughter to her mother, you need not run them down, for my father, well, he was a Navvian boy when he came to this town. When he came to this town, and he roamed around from town to town, oh, just seeking for employ. Go where he will, he's your love still, he's your own dear Navvy boy, he's your own dear Navvy boy. And it was a few months after that father died, I'm told, he left unto his daughter dear £500 in gold, £500 in gold. And when she got the money, oh, then she became my joy, and she longed to go and tramp it with her own dear Navvy boy, with her own dear Navvy boy.
The illiterate mass of the Navvying world could only hope to escape the back-breaking, muscle-tearing world of Navvying labour, leading inevitably to old age and starvation by a lucky strike, or possibly a wishful thinking dream. The story of Happy Jack the Navvy is not so greatly removed from the everyday reality of navvying life, as with pick and shovel, wheelbarrow and sheer determination, they constructed our waterways. Happy Jack, working on the line, may supply a false impression of the Navvy's world unless we take into account his lifestyle and his culture, his morality and his conditions of work. Imagine then the cut still under construction. The ganger leading his men in the backbreaking work of digging, blasting, clearing and tipping the rubble from the newly dug earth. Further back along the canal, we would see groups of navvies busy puddling or waterproofing the bottom and sides of the waterway. In the background would be a ramshackle grouping of hutments containing the navvies' few possessions, their women and children. On Sunday, you might occasionally see a hopeful band of Bible thumpers singing their hymns and attempting to instill some religious interest into those navvies who are not sleeping off the results of the previous night's carousal. The casual inquirer was not encouraged, and he would not glean any real insight into the closed community of the navigator and would probably be sent packing. The navvies' language was built up from use of current slang or cant, possibly the odd word from the Romany or Gypsy tongue, and from their own tradition. Their language was never fixed in print, other than in songs. Those few words that have been handed down to us put Happy Jack and his exploits with Fanny Brandy into context.
Happy Jack works on the line, and we may be tempted to think of this as referring to the railway line. In fact, any form of navigation was a line, and a common navvying term was to tramp from line to line, usually in search of work. Happy Jack and Fanny Brandy are both products of the navvying tradition in every respect, and their nicknames bear witness to their pedigree. Most close working communities use nicknames for the fraternity. Firefighters continue this tradition today.
I am a navvy bold, that's tramped the country round, sir, to get a job and work where any can be found, sir. I left me native home, me friends and me relations, to ramble up and down and work in various stations. I'm a navvy, don't you see? I'm a navvy in me prime. I'm a nipper, I'm a tipper, and I'm working on the dime. I left me native home on the first day of September, that memorable day. It's well I do remember. I bundle up me kit, Sunday smock and cap put on, sir. Wherever I do go, folks call me Happy Jack, sir. I'm a navvy, don't you see? I'm a navvy in me prime. I'm a nipper, I'm a tipper, and I'm working on the line. Got a job of work in the lovely town of Erie, and working on the line is a thing that makes me merry. I can use me pick and spade, likewise me old wheelbarrow. I can court the ladies too, but I don't intend to marry. I'm a navvy, don't you see? I'm a navvy in me prime. I'm a nipper, I'm a tipper, and I'm working on the line. Well, I worked a fortnight there, and then it comes a payday. And when I got me wages, I thought I'd have a play day. Then a little spree in the High Street went quite handy. I sat myself in Jenkinson's alongside Fanny Brandy. I'm a navvy, don't you see? I'm a navvy in me prime. I'm a nipper, I'm a tipper, and I'm working on the line. I called for a pint of beer, and I bid the wench to drink, sir. While she was a-drinking, she too had been in a wink, sir. Well, then we had some talk. In the back we had a rally, and jumped the brush and steel, and agreed that we'd live tally. I'm a navvy, don't you see? I'm a navvy in me prime. I'm a nipper, I'm a tipper, and I'm working on the line. We called for liquor freely, the jug went round and round, sir. It be me wedding day, I spent full and many a crown, sir. When me brass was done, old Fanny went out catching, and to finish up me spree, well, I went and slugged me lodgings. I'm a navvy, don't you see? I'm a navvy in me prime. I'm a nipper, I'm a tipper, and I'm working on the line. Well, now I'm going to leave the lovely town of Erie. I'm sorry for to leave you, lads, I've always found you merry. Call for liquor freely, I drink away me dandy. Here's a health to Happy Jack, and likewise Fanny Brandy. I'm a navvy, don't you see? I'm a navvy in me prime. I'm a nipper, I'm a tipper, and I'm working on the line. I'm a navvy, don't you see? I'm a navvy in me prime. I'm a nipper, I'm a tipper, and I'm working on the line.
Numerous other traditions and customs are touched on in our tale of Happy Jack. The navvy's play day was also known as going on a randy or knock-off Sunday. Happy Jack's casual approach to marriage can be explained by the social position of the resourceful Fanny Brandy. To jump the brush and steel was a recognised solemnisation of a common law union, living tally. Folklorists would immediately pounce on the brush and steel as symbols of fertility, and no doubt use a river of ink on the history of fertility rites. The Navi had a more limited spectrum, and his main concern with a wife, apart from the obvious, was that he was now in possession of a saleable item. The wife for sale stories that abound in our history could equally apply to the navvying world. Happy Jack packs up and leaves both Job and Fanny Brandy at the end of the song. Roaming gangs of temporarily affluent navvies raise mixed feelings in the local towns. The Tommy note kept them in their place. Payment in real money, though welcome enough in the shops, meant that the randies took place on the doorstep of the local inhabitants. Records show the results of acts of outrage inflicted on the long-suffering locals, and medical records reveal an alarming number of fractures, maimings, and even deaths among navvies and locals alike, either from fighting or from the atrocious conditions and danger of the navvying job itself. Contract finished and the navvy, redundant for the time being, was able to lean on his shovel and draw breath. There is no doubt that breath was drawn in wonder and in anticipation as the newly puddled cut was finally ready for its opening ceremony and to be put to its commercial use. The navvy allowed himself a brief period of gongoozling. A gongoozler is variously described as a curious onlooker, an idle, redundant person, or he who stares vacantly at anything out of the ordinary. Needless to say, gongoozlers were discouraged, probably with the sharp end of a shovel, by the navvies. However, throngs of gongoozlers were actively encouraged by the proprietors of the canal, especially on celebration day.
The scene for the average celebratory gongoozler must have been memorable. The narrowboats, gaily decorated with bunting, would be gliding up the newly opened canal. The navvies, freshly scrubbed, would be enjoying free beer and an ox roast. And the canal architects and proprietors would be strutting like bantam cocks, expanded with pride at what was, by any measure, a magnificent achievement. Commercial expectations for the most part were fulfilled, and in October 1809, when the Croydon Canal was opened, Mr. J. Walsh was prompted to burst into song with All Hail This Grand Day.
All hail this grand day, when with gay colours flying, the barges are seen on the current to glide, when with fond emulation all parties are vying to make our canal of old England the pride. Long down its fair stream may the rich vessel glide, and the Croydon Canal of old England the pride. And may it long flourish while commerce caressing adorn its gay banks with her wealth-bringing stores, to Croydon and all round the country's a blessing. May industry's sons ever thrive on her shores. Long down its fair stream may the rich vessel glide, and the Croydon Canal be of England the pride. And now, me good fellows, sure nothing is wanting to heighten our mirth and our blessings to crown, but with gay bells all on its banks to be flaunting, when spring smiles again on this high-favoured town. Long down its fair stream may the rich vessel glide, and the Croydon Canal of old England the pride. silent.
Mr. Walsh, we are informed by the Times of 1809, was a gentleman and proprietor. All Hail This Grand Day is a song made by a gentleman and sung most ably and zealously by the same. Mr. Walsh may have written and sung his own composition. However, we may indulge in our own speculation as to how many gongoozlers may actually have heard him singing ably and zealously above the shouts and cheers of all concerned. All Hail This Grand Day, whilst of interest to Mr. Walsh and a limited number of gongoozlers, cannot be said in any way to be a folk song. Songs of celebration certainly have their place in the song tradition, but usually they're a celebration of working life. The navvy with his boots on in the bed of the local wench, rural songs of ploughboys and their lovers, industrial songs of nailers, weavers, millers, and even policemen may be found. However, we're to look toward the upmarket typeface of the times for Mr. Walsh, all hailing his grand day. All Hail This Grand Day has its place in history on two levels. Firstly, as a celebration of human achievement, and secondly, as a shopping list of expectations. Navvy expected very little. The boatsman expected even less. But the politician, proprietor and speculator sincerely believed that a brave new world was in the offing. The grand day of October 1809 was one small cog in an industrial revolution that was to have far-reaching effects on the inhabitants of town and country alike. Mr. Walsh may have considered his workforce as only a human resource as he and his cronies lifted their glasses to their collective achievement. He probably cared little, if at all, for the fact that the previous 80 years had seen the destruction of a near-feudal way of life, which had sustained the British people for generations. He was hailing a new future that in time would claim him as a victim. The navvies, with one disparaging glance at the assembled gongoozlers, packed pick, shovel and kit, and tramped off to build the first of the railways, leaving Mr. Walsh to reap his reward in more ways than one.
In 1825, saw music hall singer Mr. Hammond bounce energetically onto the stage of the Theatre Royal, Manchester. His job was to entertain the assembled multitude to a new song, written in an old style and attached, as it happens, to an older tune. We are not to know of his success or failure, but the words did find their way into the Manchester City News in 1881, some 50-odd years later. So, somebody was listening somewhere.
I sing a theme deserving praise, a theme of great renown, sir. The Ship Canal in Manchester, that rich and trading town, sir. I mean to say, it once was rich ere these bad times come on, sir. But good times will come back again when these bad times are gone, sir. In 1825 we were speculating all, sir. We wise folks clubbed together and we made this ship canal, sir. I should have said we meant to do, for we'd a scheme laid down, sir, that should have made this Manchester a first-rate seaport town, sir.
Near Oxford Road, the dry dock is to Cork and to Careen, sir. Our chief West India dock is where the pond was at Ardwick Green, sir. That is to say, they might have been there had these plans but been done, sir, and vessels might have anchored there a full 500 tons, sir. Instead of lazy old quay flats that crawl 3 miles an hour, sir, we'd find 3-masted steamships of 90 horses power, sir. That is, had it been made, we should, and Lord, how fine 'twould be, sir, when all beyond St. Peter's Church was open to the sea, sir. At Stretford Press, which Eccles to, no weaver could you see, sir, his shuttle for a handspike change, though off he went to sea, sir. I'm wrong, I mean, he would have done, had but it been made, sir, for who would starve at weaving, who could find a better trade, sir? Alas then, for poor Cannon Street, those hookers in poor odd fish, instead of catching customers, must take to catching codfish. That is, supposing it was made, may it ne'er be a wish, sir, those cotton baits for customers would never do for fish, sir. Alas too, for poor Liverpool, she'd surely go to pot, sir, for want of trade, her folks would starve, her custom house would rot, sir. I'm wrong, they'd not exactly starve, or want, for it is true, sir, they might come down to Manchester, we'd find them work to do, sir. Success then unto Manchester, and joking all aside, sir, her trade will flourish as before and be her country's pride, sir. That is to say, if speculation can be but kept down, sir, I'm sure we've had enough of that, at least within this town, sir.
The background to his song of the ship canal is one of wrangling disappointment and general misadventure. Mr. Hammond's musical outburst is structured on a street ballad written in the time-old tradition of British satire. This style of song first appeared in the early 19th century and was a song structure attached to any lyric dealing with the subject of noted failure. The general theme of, well, he would have done, but, inspired many a confused and poetically inept scribbling sold for profit by ballad mongers and street screamers. The earliest subject matter was, of course, Guy Fawkes' foiled attempts at assassination. Well, he would have done, but... Mr. Hammond's new lyrics no doubt poached the traditional tune associated with this style of song, and the audience would have been well aware of the parody, and no doubt have chortled their support. But like most satirical pieces, it is tinged with sadness. The hopes for the future, fostered by the Industrial Revolution, had melted into a well-documented reality of unemployment, social upheaval, the disarray of long-established modes of expression, and a general disappointment.
The Manchester Ship Canal was constructed in the final flourish of a canal fever that swept the country. Speculators were indulging in a headlong rush to get in on this new way of feathering their nests. The promise of a ship canal was irresistible. What plans were made, all on a gigantic scale. The canal was to be 36 miles long, 45 to 80 feet wide, and varying in depth from 28 feet to 30 feet. It would be linked to the sea at Eastham via the Mersey and would also join the Shropshire Union and the Manchester Rochdale canals. The plan, whilst arguably the most ambitious undertaken, appeared to be beset by troubles from all angles. Comparisons with the chequered history of the Channel Tunnel project are irresistible. The Manchester ship navigation must have been beset with as much controversy, lack of funds, collision of interests, broken promises and disappointment as the Channel. The not-in-my-backyard syndrome must have reared its head. The navvies, now more organised and wiser to the company ways, must have demanded more for their labour. And generally, the whole scheme became prolonged, expensive, and a subject of ridicule.
It is worth noting that the link to the Mersey at Easton was completed a good 70 years after Mr. Hammond's squib surfaced on stage in Manchester. The times were now irrevocably changed. A new tradition in all senses of the word was in operation. 100 years previously, a short time in historical terms, life was in a safe, ordered pattern. The hierarchy, though indefensible to the socialist, was at least settled. Each man had his station. The squire and parson presided over farmer, tradesman, servant and labourer. The lowest man in his place, as God ordained according to the parson, could expect a job as a constant man, a cottage and enough land to keep a cow. The songs of the time reflected this age-old settled order. However, the confident roast beef of old England, beer-swilling romps, were soon to be replaced by bitter songs as the enclosures forced the hitherto honest ploughman with an empty flour bin to take to the woods in search of game. The poaching wars led to harsh songs of disillusionment, an exodus to the towns, and the introduction of the workhouse and parish relief. The promises offered by the Industrial Revolution melted away as market forces beyond the control of labourer, master and government took their course. It was, of course, the expendable labour force that suffered. The speculators began to look elsewhere. The competition of the roads and railways was all too apparent, and the ship canal inched forward, finally completing its journey in January 1894. It remained in use, carrying freight, until the early 1970s.
The unconquerable British spirit was to be put to the test by yet another social upheaval as the ship canal was completed. The Great War burst upon the world. Mr. Hammond was almost certainly in his grave, but he had continued a tradition of satirical retaliation that has sustained the British through so much hardship.
In our turn, Mr. Hammond's words may make us smile wryly, or maybe ruefully, at the ship canal, with its five locks. In the final analysis, the canal stands as a testament to an achievement of British perseverance, labour, negotiation and plain bloody-mindedness that can rank alongside the newly completed Channel Tunnel. The ghost of Mr. Hammond can hum his tune and remark that there is nothing new under the sun. Well, he would have done, but... The boatsman, working his narrow boat, was also a great singer. This we are led to believe by the examination of contemporary accounts. The problem for the folklorist is in the undeniable fact that the songs are conspicuous by their absence. Where are the songs of boating? Where are the celebratory verses of an idyllic lifestyle? The answer lies almost certainly in the fact that, with one or two notable exceptions, the songs never existed. One such exception is the story of the Tommy Note. The working boatsman may have been moved to sing if the weather was good and the rainwater was not running down his neck. Should spring or summer bring on a melody, it was likely to be a common folk song learned from a labourer, navvy, or worker in the pub. When songs were sung at any gathering, the boatsman would probably perform the latest music hall hit, or, if it was demanded, the story of Brennan on the Moor, learned from an Irish navvy. Maybe a drinking song from his father's father would surface, or even a patriotic squib celebrating a British victory at Alma or Waterloo. But few, if any, boating songs would find light of day.
For the most part, there was no need of specialist songs for what was effectively a cross-section audience, unless, of course, there was some great injustice that deserved an airing. The Tommy Note was a company token and was paid in lieu of wages. The Tommy Note could only be exchanged at the company stores for provisions, usually of inferior quality. The token system was first introduced for the payment of navvies. It may be arguable that this was for social as well as profiteering motives. The Tommy Note kept the navvies under control, and they were contained in one area as opposed to scattering in all directions armed with coins of the realm and the usual navvying attitude. The survival of the Tommy Note system in payment for the boatsmen had no redeeming features. It was purely an exploitative measure.
You boatsmen and you colliers all come, listen to me ditty. I'll sing yous a song before too long, it is both new and pretty. It is concerning Tommy Shops and a Highfield ruffian. He pays yous with a Tommy Note, you gotta have that or nothing. Now with them colliers I begin, and how they pay each other. Nothing had they but a Tommy Note from one week to the other. On Saturday when a week's work's done, they go to receive their money. The Highfield devil, he's learned a trick to pay him off with Tommy. And now them boatsmen I bring in that sells my fields to rank, and the boatsmen and their wives, well, they curse him at the junction, all belonging to the branch that knows the art of boating, wishing that tiller down his throat it'd be a means to choke him. When they've done their run on voyaging, go to receive their money. One half stops for ray and corn, and the other half for Tommy. To the Tommy shop we go to fetch our week's provision. Their oatmeal, sugar, salt and soap, short weight and little measure. Now if we had money instead of this provision, we could have plenty. The profit that they get out of us is 9 bob out of 20. Then we jump on board the boat and the children look so funny. And the boys and we so cheerful go to have eaten all our Tommy. Now there is one among the rest, he knows the art of boating. He vows and swears a wife he'll have so long he's gone a-courting. He vows that he will married be. Come listen to me jokes, sir. 'Cause when the parson's done his work, he'll pay him with a Tommy Note, sir.
It would be inaccurate to endow the boatsman with a wide political spectrum. And like the navvies, a boatsman would be more or less happy with a job, food, and a woman. No doubt it was a scholar who saw beyond this limited horizon, and a scholar who raised discontent and wrote the song The Tommy Note. A scholar, of course, could read and write. The idea of the artless, illiterate peasant singer so beloved by the Victorian folklorists proves to be a distortion of the driving force behind the continuation of our song tradition. We hear of groups of boatsmen, navvies, labourers, nailers and chainmakers all crowded into a pub, staring at the latest street ballad pasted on the wall and read aloud by the local scholar. The half-remembered words were embellished and rewritten to form variants and eventually super-variants of the original song. It was those educated singers who bore the great burden of the mass of traditional songs that we refer to as folk. The community remained isolated and insular. The new stipulations of the Act forced numerous families to abandon their lifestyles for a more settled shore dwelling and profession. Others continued to work the waterways, often in defiance of the rules of overcrowding and sanitation. Numerous self-styled captains of the waterways unfortunately became slaves of the wage packet even after the abolition of the Tommy Note. In their wake, they have left us their own folk tradition. their narrowboat art, adorns the boats in a blaze of colour and is admired and imitated to this day. The songs of the boating community, whilst few in number, bear witness to a working man's solidarity that was to pay dividends to succeeding generations.
Much to the surprise of the crusading reformer and the blinkered academic, the amorphous mass of individuals who forged our waterways used to take time out to laugh and have fun, usually in the face of adversity and maybe despite atrocious living and working conditions. The Cruise of the Calabar was written as a dialect or at least accented piece by Lancashire-born Johnny Greenwood in 1870, but most versions bear no resemblance to the original in tune or words and may be considered as folk songs proper. This song was certainly adopted by the boating community, rewritten again and again. Local landmarks were substituted in the text for the Rochdale Canal originals and the story became steadily more absurd. The immediate appeal of the music hall is echoed in the folk poetry, and the uniquely British ability to laugh at themselves is obviously present.
Come all you dryland sailors bold and listen unto me song. There's only 40 verses so it won't detain you long. It's all about the history of this here British tar. Who sailed as a man before the mast on the fighting Calabar. The Calabar was a clipper flat, stern fashion both fore and aft. The rudder it stuck away out behind on the wheel was a bloody great shaft. With half a gale to swell her sail, she could make 2 knots an hour. She was the smartest craft in the old canal, though only 1 horsepower. The skipper, he was a strapping youth, he stood about 4'2". His nose was red and his eyes were black and his hair was Prussian blue. He wore some leather medal he'd won in the terrible war, and his wife was passenger, mate and cook on the fighting Calabar. We sailed away with a favouring gale, the weather was all sublime. But just in the straits of Rochdale Abbey, a cat passed him at a time. Another craft ran into us and he gave us a serious check. It stove in the starboard paddle wheel box and destroyed the hurricane deck. While hugging the shore of Rochdale, lads, a very dangerous part, we ran slap into a lump of coal that wasn't marked down on the charts. To save ourselves from sinking and to save each precious life, we owe the main deck overboard and including the captain's wife. Then all became confusion while the stormy winds did blow. The bosun slipped on an orange peel and he fell in the hole below. The captain cried, it's a pirate's junk and on a shoot again. Next time I'm going to Manchester, lad, I'll take the bloody train. So we got our ammunition out to meet the coming foe. Our cutlasses and our boarding pikes, our Gatling guns also. Slap on all speed, the captain cried, for we are sorely pressed. And the engineer replied from the bank, the horses are doing his best. Thick and fast, the heroes fell, in torrents the blood was spilt. Great numbers was falling before they were hit to make sure they wouldn't be killed. And at last when the pirates surrendered her flag, the crew being all on their backs, we found she was a sister ship with a cargo of gobbler's wax. The ship is in the marine stores now, the crew in the county jail. I'm the only survivor left to tell of the terrible tale. If I could release that ship, I'd sail her off afar and be admiral of the old blooming fleets on board of the Calabar.
The fighting Calabar could only have arisen from a fiercely proud community in a way that the best Irish or Jewish jokes come from the Irish or Jewish race. More than a joke is needed to disrupt a community. If anything, the belly laughs raised by the Calabar reinforced a sense of belonging. The Canal Boats Act and economic pressures compounded by new modes of transport forced the boating community to disband. The canals, they believed, had run their course. They could not have known 100 years ago that the waterways would be revived and used purely for pleasure. The boatsman at his tiller would not have had an inkling that his art form would be imitated and adapted as the loosely based art and craft form often referred to as canalware. No pub singer would have the foggiest idea that an army of song revivalists would glean a harvest of folk melodies from his repertoire. And Johnny Greenwood would no doubt be delighted that we can still laugh at the Calabar. The final victory for the navvies, the boat builders, the painters, the boatsmen, the proprietors, and those men of yesteryear with vision and foresight, is that we now use and enjoy the waterways. When you sing canal songs, by all means raise your voice to tell of hardship and privation, but by no means forget the spirit of the fighting Calabar. This spirit is the best form of defiance, a good belly laugh at the world.
Respects, the songs of our waterways are no different from the broad mass of our folk tradition. Behind each song is a gentle hope for a better world for all. Let's raise our glass to the boatsman, to Happy Jack and Fanny Brandy, the navvy couple, to Mr. Hammond of the music hall with his satirical songs, to Johnny Greenwood and Mr. Walsh, the singing proprietor, and give them a vote of thanks. Their vision and hard work is our modern day gain, and for this, we're eternally grateful. Goodbye.